Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Craig Ellis, the Chief Technology Officer at the Go Ahead Group.
Fantastic, yep.
So I think, as we were just discussing, you have had a compelling background. I myself have done a little bit of travelling, but nowhere near to the extent that you have. And, you know, I can certainly speak from the brief experiences that I've had. And I think it really broadens the thought process. I think there's a lot of nuances involved with, I think, the confidence, amongst other things, that certainly I experienced and then I brought, I suppose, back home with me, if you like. And
yes.
I think even subconsciously carry some of those experiences with me today. You obviously did quite an extensive, you know, traveling trip along with actually working abroad. You know, I think it's a really interesting background, but you know, do you ever kind of have that time to sit back and think, you know, from a, you know, with some sense of perspective at how those things, those experiences have impacted the way that you kind of operate, you know,
yes.
You know, now?
Yeah,
I think the first thing is as you get a bit older and as kind of your life changes, I've obviously recently got married and had children, you kind of you start to develop just naturally a bit more fear about some decisions you may make or how you view your career or how you view kind of just different things, whether that's purchasing a house, purchasing a car, what you kind of want to do in your career. And I look back to when I was in my early 20s and you think kind of I wasn't concerned about kind of big changes, kind of big risk taking. It was all just being kind of very brave and very much just seeing where this goes. And I guess the first thing I recognized was I finished university in Staffordshire and I just wasn't seeing any opportunity around that area for what I wanted to do. I always wanted to really get into telecoms. This was kind of early 2000 and I could see kind of how big the internet was going to become. And there just were not them opportunities locally within Staffordshire, or I couldn't see how I could make a step from university into like a career in telecoms. And I guess really I went traveling with a very open mind of just, I'm going abroad for a few weeks, going to explore what it's like in France and Spain and Holland, and to really kind of see it as a bit of an adventure. And I had the 12 weeks out and about working for a company called Eurocamps. One life lesson is always carry your driving license. I think I told you the story where when we turned up, there was basically two roles of the people who were going to drive the vans and pick up the tents and all the accessories, and then the rest of the people were going to be cleaning the tents. And out of 12 people, only myself and my best friend who went with me had our driving licenses. So we spent 12 weeks driving around, getting suntanned arms, gaining, building up our muscles, whilst the other 10 people were cleaning tents from worms and debris and soil. So always prepare before you go anywhere and make sure you take your driving license and critical things. But I basically ended up in Amsterdam. And I was reading, a Dutch newspaper on the Monday morning, sitting outside the train station. And it had a jobs classification part. and I had a job from British Telecoms, an advert for looking for network engineers was showing. And I didn't have any work experience. I hadn't done network experience before, but I've kind of always kind of thought, be bold and take some risks. So I rang up and I got put through, and I ended up speaking to the director of the operations center, and he was actually a fellow expat. And after the initial kind of hello, we actually started discussing accents, which very quickly turned into football. So I think being an expat, one of the first lessons I learned is always try and whatever you do as a kind of a passion or a hobby. Mine was football. That's always a great segue into making new friends and just breaking down them barriers. And we started talking about, I was Stoke, he was Arsenal, and it kind of just broke the ice. And it's very difficult sometimes to get away nowadays, kind of from the professional interviews. You only have a few seconds to make an impression. People very much worry about qualifications, experience, education, but humans still relate on a personal level. It's very important to me whenever I meet people, even if my diary's busy, I always take the first few minutes just to say hello, get to know a bit about them, where they traveled off from, what did they do, did they good weekend on sports or et cetera, because that's really what bonds people. And through that, I'll kind of call it banter. I think he was more willing for me to come in and have an interview and to kind of give me the opportunity to sit down in front of him. So the next day I had to go and meet him very quickly, had to kind of put together a bit of a suit and tie, turned up, and we had an open discussion, what I'd done at university, what I'd done previously working. And at the time he said he didn't feel he'd be able to offer me the full-time job as a network operations engineer. But he really liked my passion. He really liked my kind of, exuberance and the fact I was abroad. And I kind of persuaded him. I said I was very open to learning. I was very much wanting to start a career in telecoms. I come from a bit of a working class, a traditional family where hard work, integrity is very important. And I kind of put all that over. And half an hour later, he rang me back saying he was going to give me an opportunity and could I start in 2 weeks? So from sitting at the train station thinking I was about to return home, I had an offer on the table to go and start my first full-time job at British Telecom. And once I joined, I felt a lot of pressure. I started quickly to study myself, quickly trying to understand the basics of networking and telecoms. And I guess what I also saw is hard work does take you a long way. It's a bit of a cliche, but some of the most successful people I've seen and work with are those who put in the extra effort and really do work hard. And in the first 6 months I was on probation like the other five people, I spent many a late night and many a weekend understanding the basics of telecoms, studying for what's known as the Cisco CCNA, and ensuring that I wasn't going to be let go at the end of that probation period because I really saw it as the start of my career. And also I think what's key is actually, again, I'm a big believer in talking to people, breaking down the professional into a bit of a personal relationship. And I very much started to get to know the people who were working, the people who were in the second line jobs. And I just kind of put myself out there as somebody who was eager, really willing to work hard. The shifts were 12-hour shifts, but I was quite fortunate. No real commitments. I would quite often start a bit earlier and finish a bit later. And I know it's a bit of a cliche about the most kind of famous footballers, the kind of the Eric Cantona's of this world or Davy Beckham's. But I do think it is about how much work you put in on the training pitch and not always seeing it as kind of 9 to 5 or a 12-hour shift. When you start in your career or when you're taking a new role, you really have to have that passion to kind of put in the extra effort. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I think through just I think partly through my natural persona and also a willingness to take on responsibility, I applied and was successful in becoming a senior manager with MBT, responsible for their global operations networks. And that was a major learning curve. I was the youngest member of the team, and overnight I was successful and got promoted to the manager. And it was a broad, diverse group. There was a number of Dutch people who I was working with locally. I was also managing people out in Sweden, managing people out in France, and a couple of people in the UK. So at 24 years of age, I was dealing with different cultures, different nationalities, different age sets. And that was really a key time for me to try and work out who I was as a manager, and really understanding kind of different people have different ways to motivate or to lead.
What you've kind of said so far, and I do want to continue with the next phase of the journey, but just quickly before I kind of lose the point, you know, the ability to actually work with people, you know, as you mentioned during the interview, I do think that it's overlooked now. I think the humanistic aspect of it, everything seems a little bit more transactional now. I wonder whether you've noticed that, and whether that's something now that, you know, you make a conscious effort to ensure it, you know, still exists in the workplace.
I do. And to be honest with you, although obviously my role is CTO and I'm very much a technologist, I feel it's very difficult now, whether we classify them as millennials. I really don't like that term. I was a millennial once, as in I was the youngest person. And when you're in your 20s, you're classed in a certain bracket. When you're in your 30s and you're in your 40s, what I think's really made it difficult is the smartphones and the social media and the websites. When I started my career, you had no distraction around mobile phones. You didn't have an online presence, as in Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn. You still, in a way, sounds kind of old-fashioned. You have to hold conversations with people face-to-face. And sometimes it's that thing of whenever I go to events nowadays, you turn up at an event and you see many people quickly, whether it's nervousness, whether it's introducing and meeting new people, they very quickly pull out their phones and become kind of, it's as if it's a barrier to, you don't need to hold a conversation with individuals. And I think that's a massive missed opportunity, that the number of people who you can talk to, you can learn about their life stories, what they've done, what role they play. Whenever I go to seminars and events, I personally make a conscious effort to leave my phone in my pocket, and to, it's kind of a bit like dating. You have to break that uncomfortable first few seconds when you walk over to the table and say, "Hi, I'm Craig. I'm a Go Ahead Group. What do you do?" And you soon realize many people feel the same. The minute you kind of engage a conversation, they'll engage back, and you get benefit. You make contact. Some of them go on to be professional relationships. Some of them go on to be friends. And I think for the younger generation, the so-called millennials, that's a skill they never had to learn. That's kind of come about through social media, or having this protective layer called a mobile phone, which when you're sitting in the doctor's or the dentist or a seminar or event, you can pull out the phone and pretend you're busy, or you can surf. I agree completely. It's a skill which is being lost, and the art of conversation, it basically through that conversation, it began my career. And even today, that the number of people you meet and the number of different stories and different people's experiences, it forms a relationship, and it forms a relationship. I think forming a relationship beyond that professional level is what really builds partnerships and true collaboration.
And even to within the professional element as well, you know, we technical people now, you know, the team that you'll run, there's more of an emphasis on their ability to articulate and communicate, you know, technical problems to non-technical people. You know, that now is kind of a big part of the job. And
yes,
and in addition to that, they also need to be kind of aware of the business needs. They're very much the product in a lot of instances now, where that probably wasn't the case when, you know, you were starting out, or, you know, when you were in, you know, the Netherlands.
Agree. Yes.
Whereas now they have to have that awareness. So the ability to communicate effectively, you know, is even more prominent. But yet, you know, as you say, and of course we're generalizing, but, you know, there is a society now, in the communication and the art to it has disintegrated slightly.
Yeah.
And I think also it's more complex. We now live in a world of many acronyms and terminologies and buzzwords. It's very much like the hashtag effect has created a lot of buzzwords, whether it's big data, AI, IoT, software-defined networks. And that makes it even more difficult to be able to relate back to either your employee, who's your customer, or your end user, the actual customer. And one of the things I try to do, I naturally find myself and my team, the first, say, presentation you put together is normally very over-technical. And you have to take a step back and you have to kind of relate it back to the audience, whether that's the CFO, whether it's a set of human resource people, whether it's the legal department. You have to realize with 3 and 4 letter acronyms that they won't understand. Buzzwords such as what I mentioned, IoT, big data, they're not going to understand. And you have to bring it back to simplistic terms around what you were talking about and the message you were trying to get over. And I think one of the exercises I quite often run is to, there's the OSI model, the 7-layer model, which is basically how the internet works. It's a technical model. It goes through all the different layers, physical data, network, transport, etc. Now, if you stand there and you try and present the 7-layer model to somebody, they'll switch off. They'll switch off after you start getting technical. What I actually do is I always kind of whiteboard out, how does Skype talk to Skype? So how does, for example, my mother, when she was in England and I was in Holland, how does that Skype conversation actually work through the 7 layers? And as you bring it back to a relevant discussion, you then realize what you can break down the terminology, the technology, and people can understand around unified communications or the cloud or IoT. And I always try and relate it to examples they will understand. Whenever I talk about IoT, Internet of Things, I always now revert it back to wearables. I always bring it back to whether it's the Fitbit, the Garmin fitness watch, or the Apple watch. It's about relating it to, well, you're wearing a fitness gadget. That's actually an IoT device. It's collecting data. It's gathering data. It's transporting data. And then we go, oh, right, really? Ah. And you need to relate it to something which they can understand.
Yeah. And it's probably even more paramount that we do that as well, because, you know, the rate of change of technology is an interesting one. And something that I struggle with as a not a very technical person, I'm only really aware and conscious of, I suppose, the outcomes and what that, you know, change in technology is actually going to do for me. So,
yes.
And I'm sure as a technical person, it's very easy to get lost in that and actually lose sight. You know, it was interesting that you were talking before about, you know, the vision that you had, which I would call it, to get into telecoms as, you know, at the beginning of your career. And it was, you know, you never lost sight of it. And you hustled your way into, you know, having your first opportunity, because you had that innate vision. It was clear, you know, and it was precise in what you were actually trying to achieve. I don't think that it's any different when you look at it from, you know, a technical perspective and some of the projects that technical people are working on.
Yes, except
there's, you know, so many nuances, and the rate of change is frightening. You can be in the middle of a project now, and all of a sudden, you know, the languages or the technologies that you're using might need to be changed for whatever reason. You know, within that, I think it's very easy to lose sight of the outcomes.
It is. And I've got a great example, if I could give it to you. I think the whole Office 365, Microsoft Office 365 is a great example of the last 5 years. Microsoft obviously created O365. It's a cloud product. It's about basically moving from having local applications and the Microsoft products installed on your laptop and your backend servers into the cloud. Now, we lose sight of what that really means for the end user. For the end user, that should mean what you have kind of ubiquitous connectivity. You're able to connect to your Outlook or your Word or your Excel from two or three different forms of media. It could be your laptop, your iPad, your phone, and they're able to do that from basically anywhere at any time. Now, actually, people quite often end up getting into the nuts and bolts around servers, storage, networking layers, how you configure or work with O365. And the majority of users, employees, they're not interested. They see it as a utility, but they want your O365 to be the same as your gas and your water at home. They're not interested if it works better on Wi-Fi or a wired connection. They're not interested if it's being backed up or it's being disaster recovery capability. But they're only interested in their world, which is, how do I access my emails? How do I access my presentations? And how do I use them applications to a greater benefit? And quite often with O365, we focus so much on the technical program, and we kind of lose sight of what is really just a business transformation, a business change program. And the end user, in my experience, predominantly comes out at the end of it with a feeling of dissatisfaction, and they haven't been shown how to use the new interface, the new ways to connect to Outlook or Word or Excel. So they feel it's actually a lesser service. But the benefits of O365 are never sole promoted or embedded. And they just feel, instead of being able to click on a local icon now on their computer, they now have to open a web browser. It may well be slower because the connectivity isn't as good as when it was local area network connectivity. And they feel disengaged. They then don't want to look at the benefits, whether it's Yammer or online SharePoint or integrated Teams. They only feel they have a worse experience.
From your perspective now, as a CTO, you know, that transition into, you know, a super senior role like that, these are the things that you have to then start considering. Did you have those kind of times where you look back at your kind of hands-on technical days and you saw, you know, some of the ways that you may have got lost and lost the perspective, or, you know, lost that vision, or the team had? And is it important to have people, you know, like yourself, that are able to look at it from the kind of high level perspective and kind of steer the ship?
It is. I think, to be honest, one of the things I learned very, very early on in my career, although I was a technical engineer and very much into kind of platforms and building the back end servers, I always took the time to engage with the account managers and the service managers inside BT and Interroot, because I never saw it as a them and us world. But it's very easy to kind of sometimes have a sales world and I'll call it a back office world. I always used to try and spend a bit of time and to engage with the account managers to understand what are their challenges, what are the customers pushing and most concerned about, and how what we were doing, does it relate back to the customer? And that was extremely important in a smaller company such as Interroot. When I joined Interroot in 2006, they were just kind of shy of below £100 million revenue. And within the 4 to 5 years from 2006 to 2010, they grew their revenue to over £300 million. And the customers went from predominantly a UK-US base into very much a European base with different cultures, different needs, and different norms. And it's quite easy when you're running operations or you're running break-fix to lose sight of this is affecting customers, and they have their own then challenges and problems when the service is down. So I've always tried to keep a close relationship to the kind of the customer facing people, and to really understand what is the challenges the customer's facing, what is the challenges on their business. I think a great example, Interroute was lucky to win the contract to supply connectivity to UEFA, especially the UEFA European Championship in 2010. And when we started to engage with UEFA and the account managers, you realize the kind of ginormous situation and responsibility UEFA has, which is to ensure a live football game is seen and viewed across the world at a given time, 7:45 p.m., there can be no issues. And they incorporate resiliency, they incorporate business continuity, but they still operate in a real-time environment where that football match needs to be screened and to be shown across a global audience without incident. And when you realize the challenges and pressures they face, you then really kind of become aware and kind of in a way raise your game to how important it is to ensure there is 100% uptime, there are no outages, your team's available 24/7 to ensure during that tournament there are no issues. Because if there are issues, then the ripple effect is seen in a global audience. When I joined Network Rail, and it was always a sobering experience when I used to travel back from Milton Keynes to London Euston on purpose, although I was head of technology, a very big team, and it was about architecture, network engineering, next generation platforms. I consciously used to look at the information displays and realize when we had an outage, what we designed, what we were implementing at times was responsible for whether a train was delayed or cancelled. And when you see 100 people standing at Euston, and then people are from young people trying to travel for a job interview, families trying to return home, elderly people returning from a trip to London, you really realize about critical national infrastructure and the responsibility which sits on the shoulders of Network Rail and the train operating companies. What may have been seen as a small outage actually has delayed trains, has delayed somebody being able to get to nursery, to be able to attend a job interview, and it disrupts people's lives in a way which is really impacting. And that brings a great pressure, but it also kind of brings a great motivation to ensure you're building the right levels of resiliency, availability, and your team and yourself understand the criticality of what you do. And that's a 24/7 responsibility.
With that in mind, you know, the people aspect of the technology and the rewards and, you know, keeping people engaged in what they're doing, from the perspective that you're in now, does that also help, you know, to have a job like yours where you can kind of feed back and help people be motivated at work and keep them engaged at the projects that they're working on?
It does. And I know it sounds like a cliche, but there is a difference in managing people and leading people. I think many people, there was a time when you kind of realized what the only career path many opportunities and jobs have is a progression into management. And yet I think we're now realizing that management isn't for everybody. People have different skills, different strengths, different weaknesses. And very early on within my first management job in Amsterdam, I had a difficult situation, call it performance review, with an individual who had been in the team for a long time. And the initial conversation was, that job should have been mine. Why did you get it? And I've always believed in being open and honest with people. I think that's probably a bit of working in Holland, but I could have kind of gone round in circles, and kind of talked about why I was successful and he wasn't. But I actually turned around and said, well, I'm not sure that's really going to, we're not going to gain anything from that. What probably is better to do is to understand where you want to go now and how best to see your kind of career path. And the individual in question, we did a bit of work together. He went away and he soon came back and realized he actually wasn't best suited to become a manager of a team. He was more of a kind of a specialist. And somebody who was able to work very much on projects at a technical level. And he actually went off and had a very successful career as your kind of typical chief architect, solutions consultant. And whenever I speak to him now, he turns around to me and says, it was the best career advice, Craig, I ever got. I just thought I wanted to become a manager because it was the only place I could see a next step. And I quite often when I sit down on one-to-ones and when I talk to people or when I give advice to new people starting in a workplace, I think it's important when you start to understand what your own skills are, what your own weaknesses are, because management, it can be a difficult job. You have the responsibility of the people below you. They naturally have their concerns. They want to, they look to you to for guidance and motivation and sometimes just a kind of a shoulder to cry on or somebody to moan, and that doesn't suit everybody. And I think more can be done in organizations and more can be done from HR to show there are different career progressions. There are progressions around specialisms, becoming your kind of consultants, your architects, etc. And there is still a need for strong managers and leaders to facilitate and to work in groups. But it's a skill. When I was doing my MBA, you do an MBA and you take in a lot of knowledge. It was over 2 years. And one of the key things which I took away and I still try and use today are the different styles of leadership. I think in my early career, I probably wanted to be a bit more authoritarian. I wanted to kind of be seen a bit as somebody who could kind of sometimes get angry and was your typical kind of boss who you were scared of. And I soon realized that wasn't who I am. That isn't my natural persona. And you have to work to what your strengths are and not try and kind of overly compensate your weaknesses. My own strengths, I soon recognized, were more around kind of coaching, creating kind of a democratic way of working, and kind of setting by example. And even today, you see different styles of leaders and managers. And I think the most important element is to be yourself and to work on your own strengths versus what you perceive or what you're sometimes told as a typical leader's style. Because I think that's changing. That's very much changing with the old fashioned way around kind of cohesive behavior or kind of authoritarian kind of discipline. It is still needed in certain situations, crisis management, major incidents. You do need at times an authoritative stance, but I think people respond and work a lot better in today's global kind of industries to that coaching, that pace setting, and that kind of open style of leadership.
Now, as CTO, we were also talking about this just before the show, the things that you're made aware of and the kind of premium that you have to put on externally networking and ensuring that you're up to date on what's going on in the marketplace.
Yes.
That's a huge part of the role. And, I was also just curious about some of the things that, you're really focusing on, moving forward. And obviously, I know you can't talk specifically about things, but, broadly and...
Yeah, no, for sure. So I think what really excited me when I joined the railway was the size and scale and the opportunity. The railway and some other similar industries have traditionally been kind of disparate IT networks, siloed networks of siloed applications. And the technology which is around today, this virtualization of networks, this software-defined world, is unleashing great capability. I was a part of the concept of a digital railway, and that's something which I hold very dear, and is something which I hope is a great success. We need to move away from the traditional system today around the signaling traffic lights and the restricted blocks, and to unleash that capacity which enables more journeys, enables greater capability on the railway and reduces costs. We have to use this modern technology. We have to go to open networks. We have to go and use cloud computing and big data to understand and to map out the most optimal real-time journeys of the trains. We have to move away from traditional safety mechanisms and to trust the computing power today and the systems today to make them decisions, and to make the decisions between where one train may be operating and one train may be behind. What is that distance? How can them trains get from A to B in the most optimal traffic management way? I think in my current job today, responsible for IT, technology and cybersecurity, it really is all about optimizing this great capability out there where we talk about the cloud. And the cloud for me is a bit of a misnomer. We want to be able to basically grab them economies of scale, where traditionally in the past you have your own server, it's running its own applications, and it's predominantly used Monday to Friday, 9 till 5. The ability to use shared resources, either across your company, across your industry, or across the globe, that's where the real value comes in. Being able to scale up capacity, being able to scale up for agile projects, which may need to be running for 1 month or 3 months, that's where businesses can really innovate and can ensure they're on the front foot. Especially when you see the amount of startups, the changes coming about in technology, whether it's big data, whether it's, as we talked about, the Internet of Things, whether it's the, I think, fundamental changes happening around how we do transactions. Blockchain is only one aspect of them transactions. All of these current trends are here and now, and all leaders, all CTOs, all CIOs, they need to understand how they will disrupt their business and where a business needs to focus to ensure it's relevant today, but is also going to be relevant moving forward. And that's difficult. Gartner obviously introduced the concept of this kind of bimodal working, and I do believe as a concept that's important. You need to kind of keep the lights running. You need to keep your operational business, your reputation, your kind of KPIs to your customers intact and at a level which is set out. But at the same time, you also need to innovate. You also need to be thinking about how these technologies can disrupt your business, how your consumers want to engage, want to procure, want to interact. And that's a difficult model.
It is, mate. Well, Craig, I wish we could talk for a little bit longer, but maybe we can do a part two at some point. It's been really interesting chatting with you, mate, and I think we left a lot out there to continuously discuss. So thank you so much for taking the time, mate. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com. And keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.